All right, welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. We have continuing testimony on the governor's budget, and we have several folks testifying today. For folks who are testifying, the order of testifiers will be in the agenda, from what I understand, and if that's not possible or if there's someone else, if you could just flag down one of the committee page and let us know. Our speaking times are limited. We do have quite a number of testifiers, so if we could keep testimony limited to 2 or 3 minutes, and folks yesterday were succinct and accommodating so that we were able to get through our agenda. So appreciate that again today, and we'll try to give a heads up when we're close to our 3 minute time frame and then a stop. So we will begin with Summer Spica from Home Care Workers for SEI Youth. You could approach. And on deck, Dr. George, or excuse me, Romuto, sorry. If he could approach the dais, and we will begin. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Dean and members of the committee. My name is Summer Spica, and I am a home care worker from St. Paul. I am part of the Home Care Workers Union with SEIU and a member of the union executive board, and was on the bargaining team for the first contract we recently reached a tentative agreement on with the state. I am here today on behalf of home care workers like myself and the seniors and people with disabilities that we serve to ask for your support for the small portion of this budget that funds our contract. A large chunk of the contract, nearly 70%, goes to establishing paid time off for home care workers, something most of us currently do not have. It would provide for 5 days off per year for a full-time worker. We would have sign off from our clients, so they, of course, would still receive the support they need. It will ensure a healthy and safe environment for our clients and will be a step towards ending the awful choice too many home care workers have to face regarding going to work sick or taking care of a sick family member and not having a paycheck. This is incredibly important to me because of a recent experience my family went through. My daughter Amalia, born last fall, was one of the countless Minnesotans, including most of my family, who got sick earlier this winter. In a nightmare for our family, Amalia, 8 weeks old, contracted not only influenza, but also pertussis or whooping cough. Amalia was too young to be immunized. After 2 days of being admitted to Children's Hospital in St. Paul and fighting for every breath, my baby girl was intubated, and a machine took every breath for her for almost 2 weeks. After that, she spent almost another 2 weeks withdrawing from all the meds they had her on, learning how to breathe on her own again, and how to breastfeed again. I spent most of my time, including over Christmas, in the pediatric intensive care unit with Amalia while she recovered. This meant working drastically less hours, a cut that really dug into my family's finances. This was especially hard during the holiday season. I'm happy to say that Amalia got out of the hospital a few weeks ago and is feeling better. Also, after giving birth via C-section to Amalia in October, I was forced to go back to work the day after leaving the hospital due to no PTO or ability for my client to find other care. It was the same story when I gave birth via C-section to my now almost 3-year-old. The 5 days of PTO would have not solved all of our problems, but it would have made a huge difference. Luckily, we have a strong and supportive network of friends and family, but our work deserves to have basic protections like paid time off. This contract also lifts the wage floor for home care workers to $11 per hour, a bump for nearly 40% of the lowest paid workers, and provides important funding for training. Our population is aging, and a majority of people would prefer to stay in their home, but with current work conditions and pay, it's incredibly hard to maintain a steady professional workforce. In addition to being a mother and a home care worker, I'm also a taxpayer who cares deeply about maintaining a high level of care for my client. This means it is important to ensure that money invested in the home care field is spent correctly and in a transparent way. I am proud of our inclusion in our contract that says that all new home care workers will be required to take an online orientation about how to detect and report fraud in the Medicaid system. In our campaign, we often say that we are fighting so that home care workers and the people we serve are able to live the life we choose. A slight increase in pay, benefits, and training for home care workers will be an important first step towards stabilizing our workforce, a crucial component to good care, and improve the lives of thousands of seniors and people with disabilities from every corner of our state. I ask that you support the funding of our home care contract in the budget. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. And now, next, if we could have Linda Walensky approach. And while she's doing that, if Representative Hamilton will move the minutes from February 5th and February 10th, 2015.
So moved.
Any additions, corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The minutes are approved. And next up, please, Ms. Walensky, begin with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the invitation to speak today. My name is Linda Walensky. I'm a registered nurse, a licensed psychologist. Most important, I'm here today as a mother. My husband and I adopted a sibling group of five 17 years ago, four of whom have severe mental illness and brain damage. One of the roles that I often play as a parent who's also a professional is to be on stakeholder planning and task forces. And so most recently, I was one of 10 members of a group in the state of Minnesota on the CAB Stakeholder Planning Committee. CAB stands for the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services, otherwise known as the State Hospital for Children in Willmar. And I'm going to say that because that's what makes most sense to people. The first question that we were asked when we were on the committee is whether or not if the state had a reasonable rate that they could provide to contracted hospitals, would we not need a state hospital? All 10 of us said, no, we need a state hospital. We have to have that safety net. There is no other hospital that can provide the kind of care for the very, very sickest of kids that the state hospital in Willmar does. And I want to highlight that statement with a story. One of my children, Sean, has been a patient at the Willmar Hospital three times over a period of 4 years. Sean has had a lot of things happen to him. His birth mother drank a lot of alcohol, and he has permanent irreversible brain damage because of that. His birth father was very violent, crashing his head into walls and his siblings, and he has a traumatic brain injury that's seen on functional scans. He was highly lead toxic, and that caused more brain damage. He was oxygen deprived, and that caused more brain damage. He was malnourished, and that caused more brain damage. He has seizure disorders. He has cerebral palsy. He has hallucinations and now a diagnosis of schizophrenia. As a very young child, at the start of age 3, he needed one-to-one care at all times because he was so dangerous and out of control. When he was 11 years old, he started to have the hallucinations that told him that he was dumb and stupid and he needed to kill himself, and so he did try to drown himself in the river. It took all I had to make it so that he did not die. He ended up in 9 psychiatric hospitals in a matter of 3 months. We've gone to every psychiatric hospital in the state of Minnesota. He got worse and worse. Finally, he got to CABS in Willmar, and they were able to stabilize him. He went home, and he was able to go back to school for 2 full years. Later, he needed a med change, so he went back to Willmar. That time, he had escaped and came back with bloody arms because the mafia had taken these hot needles and carved him up. And the next night, we thought he was in bed, and the sheriff brought him into the back door, finding him 3 miles away in a ditch in the winter with no shoes and no coat, because the mafia was going to kill his family if he didn't leave, and he needed to die. So he went back to Willmar, the only place that we knew that could take care of him, and they did. He has been free from hospitalization for the last 6 years. He is currently working at Goodwill, and he is a taxpayer. His older brothers, who didn't receive care, have spent most of their lives in prison. In my clinical practice as a psychologist, I have also had a number of these children whose brains are broken, and they have needed the unique care that is provided at Willmar in that hospital. There is no one else that knows how to take care of these most difficult kids. I am really concerned that these kids who have already paid so many consequences are going to pay more consequences because we want to balance the budget on their backs. I am here to ask you to please be kind to the children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walensky. Next we have Dr. George Realmuto. Welcome to the committee.
Representative Dean, Chairman, and other representatives, thank you for taking my testimony. I am the medical director for the CABS program, the program that you just heard something about, and I have a few things to say about it. As medical director for the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services in Wilmer, I am allowed to say that the governor's budget closes this mental health safety net for children in December of 2015. That plan substitutes, in the hospital's place, contracted beds in the community hospitals and opens, after a gap of 1 to 2 years, a new service called the Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facility, which is an enhanced residential resiliency building service similar to, if people know what ERTs are, it's like an adult ERT. So because I work for the state, that's what I'm able to say. I'm able to say what the governor has in his budget. But if you have other questions, I would certainly entertain those.
Thank you, Doctor. Representative Hamilton has a question. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the doctor, you know, the district in which I serve is just south of where you're located, and I know some people that work there, and they're wonderful, wonderful people. I do have a few questions. What is the position of the other, if you can speak to this, the other child mental health medical directors regarding contract beds?
Doctor.
Yes. Representative Dean, there are only a handful of other child psychiatric hospitals in the state. There's one tertiary care hospital, and that's CABS. That means we're the ICU of the community hospitals. When I've spoken to them, they said, we can't take our beds offline and put them as contracted beds. Every bed we take offline means that a kid in the emergency room can't get into a crisis bed in our hospital. Contracted beds are extended beds, extended time treatment. So if somebody's in the hospital for 4 weeks, it's four kids who couldn't go from the emergency room into their hospital. They are against contracted beds.
Representative Hamilton.
And to that point, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Doctor, to that point, are you or is CABS competing with the community hospital for patients?
Dr. Realmuto.
Representative Dean, we are complementary to the community hospitals. We serve a very small segment of the population. The kinds of cases that Dr. Lewinsky talked about, it's a small group. Thankfully, it's a small group. We have a small hospital for this group of very seriously mentally ill and complex children.
And Mr. Chairman, just one last question if I can, please.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Doctor, you know, as a legislator, you hear some complaints about the facility. With that said, what is the environment of care at that hospital?
Dr. Realmuto.
Representative Dean. The physical plant in Wilmer was totally renovated in 1998. So there's a state hospital that's been there since 1920. This building is not one of those. This is a newer building. Totally renovated in 1998, and after numerous national surveys have come through our hospital and deemed us a top performing hospital, the only psychiatric hospital in the state in the past 3 years to have that level of award. We have a very nice facility, and our rent is $3.35 a square foot. It's ridiculously low for a very nice building.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Next up, we have Ethan Vogel. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, Mr. Vogel.
Mr. Chair, I will have Barb go before me if that is all right with you.
That's great.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Barb Laidlaw, and I am a human service technician at the Wilmer Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services Facility, commonly known as CAPS. CAPS is a safety net facility for the state's most vulnerable youth. The patients we serve are extremely difficult to work with and require high staffing levels. Aggression towards staff and self-inflicted injuries are common. For instance, we have had clients use glass and plastic from light fixtures and exit signs to inflict self-injury through cutting and even ingestion. We have had numerous patients use their teeth to bite and injure staff, sometimes resulting in infections. Addressing these sorts of dangerous outbursts from patients can require the attention of up to four more staff members. Right now, we have seven staff unable to work due to workplace injury. So safe staffing levels are crucially important to our ability to serve these patients and ensure the welfare of our staff. So I ask for your help in keeping CABS open so we can take care of the kids. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Laidlaw.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Ethan Vogel. I'm a legislative representative for AFSCME Council 5. I'd like to expand a little bit on the CABS facility that we've been talking about. Representative Hamilton's line of questioning covered a little bit of what I wanted to talk about. But I'd just like to point out the flaw in the rationale used in the governor's budget proposal for closing this facility. You know, they say that they're going to close the facility, or they're proposing to do so, because it's licensed as a 16-bed hospital, but the daily census averages only between 4 and 5 patients. As the doctor said before me, the building was remodeled by the state of Minnesota in 1998, and since that time it has successfully housed up to 27 patients at once. And it was only recently that a cap limiting the number of patients served was imposed upon this facility by DHS. So the daily census average of 4 to 5 patients is due not to the physical plant structure, but to the cap that's been imposed upon it. You know, this facility is very capable of serving more patients, and we do have a need in the state to do so. And so you can see where our concern is there. Mr. Chair, we are also opposed to the downsizing of the care facilities in Wilmer and Fergus Falls and Brainerd, as well as the closure of the care facility in Carlton County. The plan to rely on private facilities to fill the void that we'd be creating by eliminating over 100 beds statewide is not going to be sufficient to fulfill our needs. This was demonstrated just 2 weeks ago up in Carlton County when Pioneer Recovery, one of the private facilities, had to refer 6 patients in 1 week to the Carlton program. You know, our facilities here need to be a safety net, and we should be working to strengthen that safety net and not weaken it. A little more of a positive note, we do thank the governor for his commitment to safe staffing levels in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And you know, proper staffing levels are absolutely crucial to our ability for successful treatment and for the safety of our staff. And finally, we do appreciate the governor's commitment to children, and we support decreasing the waiting list for the Child Care Assistance Program. DHS recently came out with a report that said there are nearly 7,000 Minnesota families waiting for child care assistance. That number is just too high, and it's been a problem for too long, and it's time we address it. And we also recognize the importance of quality care when it comes to early childhood, which is why we urge this committee to further incentivize parent aware by increasing the child care assistance payments to providers who are 1 and 2 star rated in parent aware. This would be an extension of the department's current incentives program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Vogel, and we do appreciate that. Members may want to, if you have questions specifically about the Wilmer facility and the closure, what's going to happen to those folks, and questions centering around that decision and what the plan is, we will have the department here tomorrow, and I anticipate that we will be discussing that.
Thank you.
Representative Schoen.
Just one question, Mr. Chair, and I thought the doctor that was up earlier, I would just wanted to clarify if I heard that correctly. I thought I heard someone say that there was going to be a gap in time before other options were going to be available once they closed the doors on this facility. So is it okay if I ask him, can you tell me what their plan is or what they would do, or do you want to, I can wait till tomorrow, but I just want to know if that's what I heard.
Representative Schoen, I think that would probably be a question that would be able to be directly directed to the department, and they would probably have an answer for you. And if they don't have it ready, I'm sure they do now. All right. So next up will be Lori Larson. If Ms. Larson could approach, and on deck will be Linda Higgins. And if the folks on deck wouldn't mind just moving to that back place, that's a great idea for a place to set up so we can move through quickly. Ms. Larson, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Lorraine Larson. Good afternoon. My credentials are mom. I wish the governor's budget included provisions for lifting the moratorium for the development of new licensed group homes or for more beds and staffing for crisis placements. I'd like to share my family story with you. My husband Jim and I live in Chaska with our twin daughters. Our 20-year-old son Alec, who has severe autism, is nonverbal and has significant cognitive delays, currently lives in a licensed corporate model adult foster care placement with 24-hour awake staffing in Mankato. This is my guy. Alec has been living in this type of licensed placement since he was 10 years old due to the need for a very structured and highly supervised setting which cannot be duplicated in a family home or in an independent living arrangement. Alec has struggled with behaviors, including self-injurious behaviors, hitting others, biting others, and property destruction for most of his young life. These behaviors are primarily due to his inability to communicate his basic wants and needs. Life in our family is normal, as it can be when one of your children is in an out-of-home placement, but it all started to fall apart last February 2014 when Alec's behaviors started to increase due to medication changes. We continue to work with the behavior specialist, consulted with a psychiatrist and neurologist, and trained his staff how to implement a behavior intervention program. On September 11, 2014, my son was served with a letter of demission from his current placement, stating that they were unable to continue to serve him and gave us 60 days to find a new home for him. Our county social worker went to work trying to find a new placement for him. She called dozens of providers, only to be told no over and over again, especially when they hear of his behavior problems. He's been rejected by state-operated crisis homes three times because the providers felt that they could not meet his skilled staffing needs. His high level of staffing is largely due to regulations regarding restrictive procedures or holds, which are now strictly prohibited by DHS. November 9th has come and gone, and there's no new placement on the horizon. He remains in Mankato with a provider who amazingly continues to serve him past his discharge date. I've been in contact with DHS, and they recognize the issues and limitations, but they offer no solutions. What we hear over and over again are there are no beds. The Jensen Settlement clients are first in line for crisis placements. Providers are fearful of using restrictive procedures, and we need to provide Alec with choices via the Olmstead plan. Right now, we have no choices. I'm told that there are 100 other Alecs in the state of Minnesota. I'm worried about my Alec. We're currently on day 153. I pray every day that he isn't dropped off on our doorstep, which is within the rights of the provider to do. In conclusion, I'd like to say as a Christian, I believe that I have eternity to talk to my son and all of the things that we will tell each other. And I want him to be able to say, Mom, thanks for speaking up for me. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we would like to hear from the counties, and we're going to go a little bit out of order. And first up, we're going to have Commissioner Morris, then Commissioner Higgins, and we can then go to the others on the list. But if we could start out, welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Susan Morris, an Isani County Commissioner, and I'm the Chair of Health and Human Services in AMC, Association of Minnesota Counties. And AMC represents all 87 counties in the state of Minnesota. As you know, counties play an integral role in the delivery of state-mandated human services. Counties take great pride in the work that we do serving people throughout the state. While we appreciate the additional funding in the area of mental health and the basic sliding fee child care, counties are disappointed in the lack of investment in child protection and the increased county cost shares. As you're aware, in response to concern over the safety of Minnesota's most vulnerable children, Governor Dayton created the Child Protection Task Force. In response to the initial recommendations of the task force, the governor's budget proposed an additional $2.5 million for the Department of Human Services to hire for additional staff to provide oversight. Although we appreciate the governor's investment providing needed oversight in the state level, counties are concerned that the only investment made to child protection system at the state level and not the local level, where our social workers are managing heavy caseloads on the front lines with children and families who are most at risk. I'd just like to add in here that, you know, our child protection workers honestly have probably one of the hardest jobs in the county. Every day, the fate of children and families lie in their hands. And it's an area that has a lot of turnover because it's a very stressful job. And often it's young women who fill these positions, and because of maternity leaves, there's lots of cycling in and out, which adds added extra stress onto the units. And it's very costly, and it's a double-edged sword with child protection because counties bear the full cost of out-of-home placement. So they have a huge, the weight of their decisions weigh heavily because if they choose to pull the child, it's going to cost the county directly money, a lot of money. And in Isani County, just to bring it home for you, an $80,000 is about the full cost of one child protection worker, is equivalent to about 0.5% of a levy increase. So I know that you want to partner with us and help us keep taxes low across the state, property taxes, and we need your help. And unfortunately, because people write their checks out to the counties, they see us directly as responsible. So anyway, that's side note. No extra charge on that one. In the last decade, Minnesota counties have seen a $38 million cut in state funding to our local child protection system. Currently, the state of Minnesota has the second lowest level of state investment in child protection in the nation. I'll say that again. We have the second lowest state investment for child protection in the nation. That's not good enough. Without any additional state investment, counties who already pay 50% of child protection costs are left without the funding to provide necessary services. Okay. Also, another big issue for us is that we, with the sex offender program, the cost share, it's going to have a big impact on counties, and also with the mental health issues with the NOCA facility. So thank you for this time.
Thank you. Commissioner Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Hennepin County Commissioner Linda Higgins. While there are many good things to support in the governor's budget, I'm here to express concern about the change recommended on page 90 of your budget book for the increase in cost of care for patients at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center to go to 100% county cost share starting July 1st of this year. You don't need to raise the county costs to get our attention to the need to move patients out of Anoka as soon as they are medically able. At Hennepin County Medical Center, our own county hospital, we have patients waiting to be admitted into Anoka. Our county has dedicated staff who work hard to find placements for patients ready to leave Anoka. Some clients, though, are really difficult to place. Just as a reminder, these are people who have been deemed dangerous to self or others and have chronic health conditions. They might be mentally ill. They might have a brain injury. They may very well be violent. They may be on dialysis. But there is not housing with services that can meet the complex needs of the clients who end up in our counties. Governor Dayton recognizes this in proposing three state-operated services facilities to be created over the next 3 years. We support this proposal because we know how hard it is to find providers who are willing and able to serve clients with these multiple challenges. But these 10 to 12 bed facilities will be phased in over 3 years, and even the three of them won't eliminate the waiting list for services at Anoka. Meanwhile, the counties will be charged more beginning day one of your new fiscal year. But day one of your new fiscal year is in the middle of our fiscal year, and we haven't budgeted for the increased cost, estimated by our fiscal staff at Hennepin County to be $2 million to our county. But even when we do our budget for next year, the cost will take resources away from other critical services the states need us to provide, such as child protection services, foster care services, child support services, subsidies to mental health services, and the list goes on and on. So during a budget surplus year for the state, we hope that this budget recommendation that shifts costs to the counties will not be adopted. Thank you for hearing our concerns today.
Thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate your time today. Next, we have Mark Sizer and Renee Braundeinst and Nancy Selesky. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Sizer. I'm the Human Services Administrator for Stearns County, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, otherwise known as MACSA, which represents all 87 of Minnesota's counties. First of all, I'd like to applaud the governor's additional investments in two areas: one, mental health services, and two, the basic sliding fee child care assistance program. We feel that these investments will directly benefit the clients we serve. Having said that, however, I cannot overstate MACSA's disappointment in the fact that two of our remaining priorities received inadequate attention in the governor's budget proposal. MACSA has worked closely with DHS to promote the process of simplifying the administration of economic assistance programs. Last year, you appropriated dollars to help us start aligning the eligibility processes for Minnesota Family Investment Program, General Assistance, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, and Group Residential Housing. These improvements are allowing us to provide better service, modernize our technology, and create both time and cost savings. However, this work is far from being done. The DHS Program Uniformity and Simplification Workgroup recommended additional phases to complete this work. Phase 2, approximately $200,000, is not included in the administration's budget proposal, but we hope it can be included in this committee's bill. Finally, we all share a desire to improve Minnesota's child protection system, whose challenges have come to light for all of us over the past year. Our members, from whom this committee has heard, are working closely with the governor's task force and look forward to its final recommendations in March. We are very disappointed, however, that the on-the-ground delivery of child protection services was not given equal consideration in the administration's recommendations. Although the state created the child protection system and mandates counties' efforts, its funding has declined by at least $36 to $38 million over the past decade, with counties left to try to pick up the tab. The proposed budget neither seeks to make us whole for those past cuts, nor provides any new support for county social workers who are already managing large caseloads as they work directly with children and families each year. On a personal note, 2015 marks my 39th year in county government, and 36 of those years were in corrections as a probation officer and corrections administrator. I thought that was the toughest job in county government. As a human services administrator, I now realize that child protection workers have the most difficult job that we encounter. We hope that Governor Dayton will provide this funding in his supplemental budget proposal in March, or that you will include it in your omnibus bill. which will allow greater steps to be made towards providing counties with adequate resources to carry out the very good work that child protection social workers do across the state of Minnesota. I want to thank you for your time this afternoon. MACSA looks forward to serving as a resource for you and working with you during this legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sizer. Next, we have Renee Fraundienst. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Renee Fraundienst, and I'm the Public Health Division Director for Stearns County Human Services. I also serve as the legislative co-chair for the local Public Health Association, and I'm actually here today in that capacity on behalf of the city, county, and tribal public health agencies across the state that are serving our Minnesota communities and keeping them safe and healthy. Funding for the local public health grant for home visiting and for the statewide health improvement plan were actually identified as key items in the governor's budget related to health in the state of Minnesota. And these priorities fit very well with the local public health association priorities, and we're in support of those items. While we do appreciate the funding that's identified in the governor's budget for the local public health grant, we are disappointed in the level that it's at and the conditions that were set out in the budget. For your information, the local public health grant is one of the main sources of funding for state investment in the Minnesota public health system. These are non-competitive dollars, and they're intended to support local governmental public health services across the state and actually provide local policymakers with the ability to direct the dollars to locally identified issues and priorities. It is commonly used across the state to respond to items such as infectious disease outbreaks or situations such as tuberculosis, pertussis, measles, or foodborne outbreaks, and most recently planning for Ebola with our local partners. Over the past years, these dollars have decreased steadily. In 1976, when these dollars were initially appropriated, they were at $7.25 per capita, and they are currently at $3.90 per capita. And this places Minnesota 44th in the nation in their investment in public health. In 2003, in response to the state deficit, the local public health grant was actually reduced by 29%, and those dollars have not ever been reinstated. With that loss, there were many program and staff eliminated across the state and have never been restored. Some examples just for you include some outreach for children with potential developmental delays that have been cut, sexually transmitted infection prevention education, some local laboratory capacities that were eliminated, home care services eliminated, education with youth around alcohol, just to name a few. While communities have been trying to fill the gap, they are still unmet across the state. And those communities are still identifying the needs in these program areas and requesting counties consider reinstating those. Just a more recent gap example around Ebola, we have done some review of the dollars spent, $300,000 to date, by local public health agencies just to respond to the Ebola planning process. What we're respectfully requesting the committee consider today is to restore those funds to the 2003 amount and use the current process to disperse those, which makes them statewide. Restoring this grant to the 2003 would allow for local policymakers to direct those resources for those priorities that have been identified by the community, specifically around infectious diseases, mental health, chemical health, chronic disease prevention, environmental health, or supporting the local infrastructure for public health. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes, thank you.
Next, please proceed with your testimony, Ms. Selesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Nancy Selesky, and I represent the Minnesota Intercounty Association, which is also known as MICA. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. First, the good news. We are very happy that the governor recommends some positive investments in health and human services. Specifically, we appreciate his investments in mental health as well as the child care tax credit. However, there are a number of items that are missing from the budget that we just kind of want to I guess, highlight. You've heard from a number of county representatives about child protection. MICA feels it important to reiterate again that there is no funding in the governor's budget that would be directed toward counties. We also want to remind you that the county levy is more than 50% relative to child protection costs, while the state's funding is 20%, and as Commissioner Morrison testified previously, we're second lowest in the country on that. There's also no funding in the governor's budget relative to non-emergency medical transportation. Counties are required to provide what is called access transportation services for ambulatory medical assistance clients to get to and from their health appointments. We manage the rides for clients who have a lower level of need for transportation. As an example, counties make arrangements for bus tokens, volunteer rides, cab fares, etc. DHS currently provides similar transportation services for non-ambulatory ME clients. These clients have higher transportation needs, including those who would need a vehicle equipped to accommodate, for instance, stretchers or wheelchairs. Finally, DHS currently does the evaluation for MA clients to determine what level of transportation services is needed. In 2012, the legislature appointed a task force to look at this issue. Last year, that task force forwarded its recommendations to unify administration of both modes of transportation, what the counties are currently doing as well as what the department is currently doing, and combine that and have counties manage it with the proviso that a new rate structure would be established and implemented and a web-based system would be implemented and funded by DHS. In addition, it was agreed that counties have to be made whole for the new responsibilities that we would be taking on, including the level of need assessments and additional administrative costs relative to dispatch. The goal for setting up this web-based system is July 1st of 2016, but again with the provision that DHS develops and funds the system. Lastly, when counties picked up part of the service in 2009, some counties in the metro area contracted with a transportation coordinator to keep the costs down for individual counties. We do need to ensure that counties or groups of counties do retain flexibility in the management of this transportation system by utilizing a private coordinator if so desired. And with that, I thank you for your time and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, we have Ms. Sue Aberholden from NAMI, and on deck, we have Ben Wortman. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Aberholden. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. So as you can see, I'm wearing a hard hat, and I'm not wearing it to fit in over here at the Capitol, but rather to make a point. 10 years ago, I would have said that we have a broken system of mental health care, but not today. Today, I believe that we know what works. We have the foundation for our mental health system. Now we need to build on it. Many of the items in the governor's budget build on what we have and work towards increasing access and quality. I want to point out that many of these services started as part of Governor Pawlenty's budget in 2006 and 2007, which were passed by a Democratic legislature. These are bipartisan issues. I want to highlight a couple of the provisions that NAMI is most supportive of. First is crisis services, and I have a handout that's in yellow. If you want to really prevent emergency room use, inpatient hospitalizations, and jail time, this is the most effective program that there is. There are a few changes that are being proposed by the governor. One is to have one number to make it easier to publicize. Right now, we have many. We need more uniform standards, and we need to be statewide. The governor proposes to increase the rate to that of an office psychotherapy visit, but it may need to be higher. We may also want to look at startup funds for crisis residential beds. The next issue is first psychotic episode. When you go to the doctor and the doctor says you have cancer, they don't say come back when you hit stage 4, but that is what we do in the mental health system. We tell you to come back after you've been hospitalized numerous times or committed. What this program does is actually prevent these illnesses from becoming disabling. So you identify people early and you provide the intensive treatment that is warranted. It's now an average of 74 weeks before people receive treatment after experiencing psychosis. Mental health workforce shortages are real, and the one residency slot is a great start that's in the governor's budget, but we need more, especially in child psychiatry. The governor includes an in-depth rate study for mental health services, and certainly we need recommendations in that area to make sure our mental health providers remain viable and strong, but we also need increased rates. Respite care is sorely needed by families who have children with serious mental illnesses. They need a chance to recharge their batteries, and there is more money for that. Expanding our assertive community treatment teams, which are like hospitals without walls, including forensic assertive community treatment teams for people coming out of prisons, makes a lot of sense. They're very effective in supporting people with the most serious mental illnesses in the community. There's more money for housing with supports, and they're needed in every county of the state, and you can't recover without stable, affordable housing and supports. And then eliminating co-payments for smoking cessation products is also important, since adults with mental illnesses have the highest smoking rates. There are a couple things that were not included. Just briefly, increased funding for SchoolLinked and new funding for youth shelter grants, funding for protected transport, and increasing suicide prevention grants. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Aberholden. We appreciate your testimony and your hard hat. Very, very good.
You'll remember me.
We have a rule against props but not hats, so you are good. You are all good. Mr. Wertman.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ben Ashley Wertman. I represent the Mental Health Association of Minnesota, and our vision is improved lives for Minnesotans living with mental illnesses. We have 75 years of history supporting this, and I want to be here today to voice our strong support of many of the items contained within the governor's budget. As you well know, other members of the Mental Health Legislative Network are testifying today, so I'll just focus on two aspects of particular interest for the people that we serve. We have two programs that serve people throughout the state. We go out to local advisory councils, and we talk with those groups about how they can be more effective in planning for the needs in their community. And we also serve people who call in all around the state. They have trouble accessing services, and they need some navigational assistance to get them pointed in the right direction or resolve a conflict with a provider, a landlord, somebody like that. From those experiences as a client advocate and visiting those local advisory councils, I can tell you without a doubt that one of the most impactful moments where people truly have a sense of pride in their recovery is when they can talk about avoiding a near miss with hospital level of care. I knew I was getting bad. I knew that I needed help. I was able to call a friend. I was able to call a crisis line. I was able to stay in a crisis residential bed. Whatever resource they used, they talk about that experience with pride because they know that it's something that they may have to do again, and it's something that they now know that they are capable of. And it's so important for both their outcomes and our costs. I've given you a handout with a brief overview of numbers about the success rate with mobile crisis and residential crisis. They are wonderful programs, but they are lacking in some areas of the state. In some counties, there really is only a phone number and a call-in service, but there's no direct outreach or in-person setting that person can go to. The other item that I want to highlight is safe, affordable housing and transition options. We've heard several times today about the concern for individuals, particularly in Anoka, who are hard to place, who might be homeless on discharge, and I don't have to tell you how bad of an idea it is to take somebody from Anoka, spend a lot of money getting them better, and then put them back out onto the street without housing supports. It ends up being largely catastrophic outcomes. The Bridges Housing Program, it currently serves 707 households, but the waiting list is almost double that number. And the governor's budget contains new investments in this area to help meet that unmet need, get some of those focus moving from Anoka and back out into the community. We're particularly grateful for all of the attention that the Department of Human Services gave in coming up with proposals that met the community's needs. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next up, we have George Klosser, and then on deck, we have Laura Sales. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is George Clouser, and I'm happy to say I'm the proud father of an adult daughter with disabilities and the executive director of the Altair Accountable Care Organization, which represents a collaboration of top community and medical providers representing about 6,600 people with disabilities, or approximately 10% of the current disability population in the state on waivered services. I'm here today in support of the HCBS Innovation Pool in the Governor's Budget that you'll find on page 143. This proposal is designed to return significant savings, real money, back to the state of Minnesota for those individuals with disabilities living into community housing and employment. This innovation applies a strategic approach to the current service delivery models, thus allowing us to redirect savings to new staffing models that could provide self-funding of other programs in DHS. Our strategic approach includes an implementation of the life plan that supports the pillars of the Olmsted plan, leading to greater independence for all people with disabilities. We ask for your serious consideration of this proposal. If you allow me to share a story to an individual that we'll call John. John is disabled. He lived in a group home for 22 years, guided by his elderly parents to always have John in a safe environment. When John's parents passed very recently, he expressed a serious passion for getting his own apartment. Now, John had some health problems that prevented him from getting a job in the community. With the support of his sister, case manager, and a provider, they started working on a plan. This plan identified the priorities for John's success and achievement in his goal to live and work in the community. I'm proud to report that John is now living in the community. I was over for dinner a few months ago. He's working at the corner pharmacy and has his type 2 diabetes under control. He's been eating healthy and has met a lot of new friends in his apartment building. We also project that John will save the state of Minnesota $30,000 to $35,000 in 2015 off of his 2014 reimbursement. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about this unique strategic approach.
Thank you, sir. And next up, we have Laura Sale. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, Representative Dean, members of the committee. My name is Laura Sales, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association. You're getting a letter from us, so I'm not going to read the whole thing in the interest of time. I'm just going to point out some highlights, so because there's a lot of people left to testify. One of the things we're supportive of in the governor's budget is the fiscal year 2015 deficiency funding for the Minnesota Security Hospital, as well as the ongoing funding to continue the improvements needed there because of the conditional licensing. Nurses there are responsible for admissions and discharge work, instruction about the permissible use of interventions, in some cases authorizing use of those interventions, writing of abuse prevention plans, and overseeing critical assessments and medication. So in short, without these registered nurses, the security hospital would not be able to meet the conditions of the conditional licensure. Some other things we're supportive of, we appreciate the governor's goals in wanting people to be served in appropriate setting close to their families and friends, but like some of the other people that have already testified, we have concerns about the closing of the CABS facility out in Willmar. And then lastly, we await more information on the enrollee cost sharing and premium increases in the creating a sustainable Minnesota care program proposal. MNA supports the creation of a healthcare system that covers everyone, and we have concerns about any proposal that could make maintaining healthcare coverage more difficult for any citizen to maintain. So we look forward to working with you and the governor on these proposals as they move forward. So thanks.
Thank you so much for your time, and we do appreciate you condensing your testimony. And members have the letter that was passed out, so we have that. Also, the remaining testifiers, please be aware that we do have a very limited time. We have a hard stop at 2:30, so anything we can do to move up the testimony. I realize that we just have a very brief time, so appreciate that. We could have Ms. Jenny Johnson from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, followed by Dr. Mike Helgeson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ginny Johnson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, and I also have a written copy of my testimony moving around. The Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers represents the 17 federally qualified health centers across the state of Minnesota who serve approximately 177,000 individuals at 72 different sites. The mission of the health centers is to serve everyone who comes through our door, regardless of their ability to pay. And in that light, 30% of our patients are uninsured, and about 45% of our patients are on public programs. We're very proud to serve our patients with high-quality, comprehensive primary care, and this includes medical care, behavioral mental health, and dental services all under one roof. In addition, we are community-based organizations, and we're very proud to be accountable to the communities we serve. Every clinic board of directors is comprised of 51% patients. To the governor's budget, we're very supportive of many proposals, and we look forward to receiving more clarity on several line items. To start with the integrated care for high-risk pregnant women, we're very supportive of an intervention program that works with community-based organizations, and we look forward to partnering with them. Health centers have a long history of outperforming the low birth weights in Minnesota, and we're very proud of that. Within the governor's proposal for an oral health initiative, we are supportive of the additional coverage for periodontics for adults. For behavioral health homes and certified behavioral health clinics, we support both initiatives that improve mental and behavioral health care access and improved integration with primary care. We look forward to how the certification process will roll out and how this process will impact healthcare homes. In addition, we have two clinics who are early adopters of behavioral health homes, and so we're excited to see how they can participate. Similarly, we are very supportive of the state's efforts to secure a demonstration project grant to be a state for certified behavioral health clinics. And again, we're looking forward to more clarity on how that program will roll out. Regarding Minnesota Care, for federal basic health plan compliance, we are very supportive of the governor's decision to reduce premium rates. However, if other proposals within the governor's budget would ultimately increase costs or reduce affordability to Minnesota Care enrollees, we would be concerned about that. Lastly, we look forward to having more conversations with committee on two of MNAC's priorities, which were not included in the governor's budget. The first being that we are seeking a $2 million increase to an appropriation that the health centers receive from the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care within the Department of Health. We use those funds to address health disparities, improve care coordination, enhance data analytics, and participate in the market's health reforms. We strongly believe that we owe it to our patients to bring them the same best practices the rest of the evolving market can access. And second, we are seeking the reinstatement of Medicaid co-payments for approximately 2,000 health center patients who are duly eligible for Medicare and medical assistance within the state. And we'd like to thank Representatives McDonald and Grunhagen for carrying those initiatives for us. So thank you very much for allowing us to testify on the governor's budget, and we look forward to working with you moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Helgeson. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Michael Helgeson, the Chief Executive Officer of Appletree Dental. I'm a dentist with advanced training in the care of adults with disabilities and frail elders. As many of you know, Appletree is a nonprofit group dental practice that delivers care to children, adults, and elders who face barriers to care in five urban and rural regions across Minnesota. 80% of the care we delivered last year was provided to Minnesota Healthcare Program enrollees. Appletree uses trucks and mobile dental offices to create year-round dental homes in a variety of sites ranging from Head Starts and schools where we treat children, to group homes serving disabled adults, to nursing facilities serving frail elders. Last year we treated 28,000 individual patients and provided just shy of 80,000 dental visits and screenings. But low medical assistance reimbursements created an operating deficit for our organization last year. And despite growth, we had thousands of patients on waiting lists at our clinics across the state. I'd like to give the governor a dental checkup relative to his budget. I am very pleased that the governor proposed to update dental reimbursements, which were last reset in 1989, more than a quarter of a century ago. And I salute the governor for recommending using reimbursement data from the current century and, in fact, from the current decade. I think it's terrific, but it is a little long overdue, in my opinion. According to the American Dental Association's most recent report, comparing state Medicaid reimbursements for dental, Minnesota now ranks 50th at the bottom. We have the lowest reimbursement rates for children in the 50 states and the 46th lowest reimbursement rates for dental when adult and children's services are combined. Today's medical reimbursement, medical assistance reimbursement rates for children are about 27% of the average charges of a dentist in Minnesota, compared to a national average among the 50 states of 49%, or near 50% of average. In contrast, Alabama Medicaid reimburses 54% of average dental charges in Alabama. Texas pays 59%. And West Virginia pays 70%, and all of these states have higher access for their children who are dependent on Medicaid than we have here in Minnesota. I believe Minnesota has a responsibility to provide access to medically necessary dental care for vulnerable children, adults, and elders who depend on us, but we're failing. We're dead last. I believe it's a shame for such a great state to continue neglecting such a basic need. Today, I want to talk just very briefly about the impact on critical access providers. We are experiencing cuts right now before the governor's budget due to some changes in administration among the health plans. And while the governor's proposal raises rates from 27% of average up to 31% of average, I believe we must make a more meaningful step towards getting to the average, which would rank us in the middle of the states. But I am very concerned that the governor backs out these rate increases for the critical access providers. Critical access providers are like Appletree, Hennepin County, the University of Minnesota, Children's Dental Services, treat some of the most challenging and costly patients in the state. And our costs have been rising, and we're all struggling to sustain our program. So I believe that the rate increases should be distributed across both non-critical access and critical access providers. And then finally, removing critical access payments from Minnesota Care will make it nearly impossible for them to get dental care. That impact of that cut on Appletree alone is over $250,000. And we're already not afloat this last year covering our costs. So I think it's not a good idea to cut critical access benefits there. So in closing, I would encourage you to raise the base rates for all the providers this year, both critical access and not. Also to support university-based research to discover better ways to both deliver care and reimburse care. And finally, to direct the health plans and the Department of Human Services to simplify administration and reduce administrative barriers to the program.
Dr. Augustin, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there because we are running over, but Representative Liebling has a question.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And real quickly, Dr. Helgeson, thanks for everything that you do. I just wanted to clarify, when we're talking about raising dental rates, we're talking about, are we only talking about our fee-for-service patients, or are we talking about, I mean, the vast majority of our patients who are on medical assistance or Minnesota Care are under PMAP, right? And even raising the rates as proposed, does that affect those patients or only the fee-for-service people?
Dr. Yeah. Helgeson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I believe that the way the governor's budget is written makes it somewhat ambiguous as to whether or not the PMAPs would have to pass that increase in base rates through to the providers. They're currently free to reimburse providers at whatever rate they wish, and in reading the governor's recommendation, it does not clearly state that that base rate increase would need to be passed through to the dentists on the other side.
Thank you, Dr. Helgeson.
Thank you
and all the dentists for all the great work that you are doing in a tough row to hoe, and thank you for giving the governor an overdue checkup. And
thank you.
At least you didn't nag him for not flossing.
Right? There we go. Thank you.
All right. Bill Haas and then Dr. Don Jacobs on deck. Mr. Haas, please proceed to the dais. State your name and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
I'm Bill Haas. I represent White Earth Tribal Nation. In 2007, the chairwoman, Visner, decided that it was time that we needed to improve services to the people in White Earth. And so she said, let's see what we can do as far as entering into partnerships with DHS to do that. And our first project was a drug rehab facility for Indian tribal children. And it's one of the first ones in the nation. And we successfully have opened it. It's still operating today. And what we did on that partnership is we were able to eliminate the cost for the counties and the state for the treatment of those tribal children because we could access federal funding. And since that time, we've looked for other partnerships and opportunities, and the one that's in the budget this year is the opportunity that this legislature passed in 2011, where White Earth took over the human services functions for all tribal members from Clearwater, Becker, and Manoman County. This endeavor has saved the county's money. It is saving the state money going into the future. Early on in those discussions with DHS, there was a question about how the tax money from the counties would flow to the tribe, and it was decided at that time in discussions with the county, DHS, and the tribe that there would not be any, but we would look at the reimbursement of administrative costs for White Earth as an ongoing expense. Now, White Earth is bared the brunt of the startup costs for this project. In fact, they had to run 20 miles of fiber optic cable to one of their outlying communities to set up a satellite office to service their members. Currently, they have transferred 1,800 cases, which is around 10,000 people, to service, and they have been hiring and up and running and providing the service they need. So we just ask for your support in the budget for the administrative costs that we have worked with DHS to identify, and we'd like to thank DHS staff for all their help, and the commissioner and the governor for putting this in his budget. And we are also exploring into the future and actually in dialogue with DHS right now for other partnerships where we can work with the state to save the state and the county's money and yet improve the services to White Earth tribal members. So we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Haas. Next up, Mr. Jacobs. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Dean, members of the committee. My name is Don Jacobs. I'm a general surgeon by training and spent most of my clinical career providing care within our healthcare safety net. I'm here today as president of the Minnesota Medical Association and appreciate the privilege to address the committee today. The MMA appreciates and is supportive of the governor's proposals to address the serious gaps in capacity and workforce necessary to meet the needs of those with mental health conditions. We're particularly pleased to see the proposal to have the state step up and support a new residency training program for psychiatrists. More innovative funding ideas such as this will undoubtedly be needed to help reshape the future physician workforce, given the unwillingness of the federal government to remove the current caps on residency training positions. While the mental health workforce needs are vitally important, the MMA is disappointed that the governor proposed nothing to address the looming critical shortage of primary care physicians. Current projections indicate a shortage of over 600 primary care physicians by 2020 and a shortage of nearly 1,200 by 2030 in Minnesota. We believe this is a problem that needs your attention now. The MMA urges you to help address the physician shortage by supporting expansion of the current loan forgiveness program. It has been effective. As an example of the current program's loan forgiveness, 88% of physicians receiving that support cite the program as an important influence on their decision to practice in rural or underserved areas. In addition, 86% of physicians continued to practice at their facilities even after the loan repayment obligation ended. Representative Keel's bill, House File 211, is a comprehensive package to fund the rural health care workforce that we encourage you to pass. While loan forgiveness can help incentivize the distribution of scarce physician resources to underserved areas, broader investments in primary care services are needed to encourage careers in primary care and to improve access to preventive services, health education, and care for all Minnesotans. The evidence is very clear that adequate Medicaid payments for these primary care services are critical to ensuring that patients will have access to care. The ACA recognized this and required all states to increase their medical assistance payments for primary care services to the Medicare payment level with the cost paid for by the federal government. Across the country, that provision resulted in an average increase in primary care Medicaid payment of 73% for the past 2 years. Minnesota experienced an approximate 36% increase in primary care Medicaid rates. The effect of that increase has been demonstrated to improve patient access to care across the country. The Medicaid payment increase ended, however, December 31st, 2014. At least 15 states now, as diverse as Iowa, Maryland, Alabama, Mississippi, and Colorado, have recognized the connection between improved primary care payment and access to primary care services and already acted to continue the Medicare equivalent payment rates. The MMA strongly encourages you to do the same. Minnesota's current 47th place national ranking for Medicaid physician payment rates deserves as much attention as does the 50th place
ranking for dental service. Representative Gruenhagen has a question. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Jacobs. Just back to the primary care shortages, and especially acute, I think, in rural areas, as you indicated. What do you see as the primary reason for that shortage? Is it the additional people insured under the ACA? Is it that the doctors are reaching an age where they're just going to retire, and we're not educating them their replacements fast enough? Or what do you see as the primary causes that are producing that? I know Medicaid reimbursement is possibly one of them. But
I think the two you mentioned are strong drivers. As the economy improves, physicians are starting to retire where they were hanging on. But the primary driver is within our current payment system, primary care physicians aren't paid as well as others. And so with students coming out of training now with $150,000, $250,000, $300,000 of debt, they're choosing more lucrative specialties and not choosing primary care. So this is an important strategy to reshape the workforce.
Thank you, Dr. Jacobs.
One follow-up question.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Several states are experimenting. I think Indiana. Kentucky or Tennessee, Arkansas, and I think Ohio, with privatizing some of the Medicaid reimbursement system in a way that actually results in higher reimbursement to doctors and hospitals. Are you familiar with any of those reforms?
I am, Jacobs. Yes.
Do you think any of them are worth pursuing in terms of reducing costs yet increasing reimbursement to doctors and hospitals?
I think we've got the critical issue is the payment rate, not necessarily the source of the program. So if we're trying to incentivize a reshaped workforce that provides more primary care to our population, the source of the payment isn't as important as that critical care source. We just have before us the opportunity to take advantage of what was put forward for increased Medicare rates. There is payment to the states from the federal government to accept that program.
Thank you, Dr. Jacobs. Next up, we have Steve Scogie from Productive Alternatives. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Scogie, and I'm the president of Productive Alternatives Incorporated, which is a private nonprofit human service agency based in Fergus Falls. I'm here today to give testimony regarding the governor's budget proposal specific to the plan to include detoxification services as a covered medical assistance benefit. Productive Alternatives operates a 12-bed detox facility in Fergus Falls, which began operation in 2006 at the request of County Social Services following the closing of the detox program at the Regional Treatment Center. At that time, our main service area consisted of our home of County of Otter Tail and a few surrounding counties. By contrast, in 2014, we had admissions from almost 30 counties, and alcohol was not necessarily the primary admission, considering the increased abuse of prescription medications, opiates, and methamphetamines. We had almost 600 admissions in 2014 and would expect no less of a number this year. In the last several years, closures of detox facilities in Crookston and Brainerd have left us as one of a few remaining programs in the northwest part of the state. Our issues are reflective of those faced by all detox facilities in rural areas. We struggle with attracting and retaining staff, particularly those with RN and LPN credentials. Due to funding constraints, our wage scales and benefits have diminished. We've had to raise our wages to remain competitive without appropriate resources to do so, resulting in losses over the last 2 years of almost $90,000, and we anticipate potential losses this year as well. We are appreciative of the efforts of the Department of Human Services to recognize the seriousness of these issues across the state and to have developed a plan to include detoxification services as a covered MA benefit. The plan calls for detox facilities to be able to meet medical assistance standards for care, which will require staffing to include RN and LPN personnel on a 24/7 basis. Our current facility is staffed at a subacute level, meaning that we have our RN staff on an on-call basis. We employ technicians to provide the intake process and direct care. We have been able to provide a quality level of care with a labor pool that gives us a reasonable chance to find potential employees that we can train to our standards. We agree that there's a greater need for detox services throughout the state and that services have become more complex with addictions, mental health issues, and acute and chronic medical needs. However, we are concerned that the plan submitted by the department is dependent on gaining medical assistance funding. It is our concern that if those dollars do become available, we will still not have sufficient funding with this plan to offer a competitive wage to the professional staff needed, and that even if we do have these funds, there is not enough of a professional pool of staff available in rural areas. Also, the request to the legislature is only for permission to apply to the Federal Medicare Medicaid office. Any hope for approval and funding is at least 2 years away and likely more. The governor's plan also calls for elimination of the care unit in Fergus Falls, which is an inpatient treatment facility which will have a negative impact on our detox program for those served. Again, we appreciate the effort by the Department of Human Services, but would ask for a consideration of funding for another level of non-MA level of care that might better fit our situation and help us preserve the care unit in Fergus Falls. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Erica Moss, followed by Dr. Veronica Svatez. Please come to the dais. You could state your name for the record. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Erica Moss. I'm the executive director of an organization called Parent Aware for School Readiness. It's an independent nonprofit supporting the statewide expansion of the Parent Aware ratings and early learning scholarships. I'm here today in support of the governor's budget, including some initial state investment in the Parent Aware rating system. The system, members, has been developed over a period of years, beginning with private investment as part of a $20 million pilot project, and then a statewide expansion fueled with federal Race to the Top grant dollars that came to the state. So for the first time, the program is looking to the state for resources to continue to expand and grow the program. Just a couple of highlights from 2014, which was a strong year for Parent Aware. There's been a 150% increase in the participation of licensed family child care programs, 100% increase in the participation of non-accredited child care centers. We have 90% of providers participating, saying they leave the program with an overall positive impression, and more than 70% saying that it's helped the children in their care. And in addition, just some highlights of areas of the state where ratings are going particularly well. In Hennepin and Ramsey County, 60% of providers of color are rated and participating in the program. And there are several counties in greater Minnesota, Clearwater and Carleton are a couple of examples where ratings participation has exceeded 30% of eligible providers. In addition to that, the rating system is also a tool for parents to help them identify child care providers in their area who are using kindergarten readiness best practices. And during 2014, we hit a high of 10,000 parents in 1 month using the Parent Aware website to search for a provider in their area. So for all of these reasons, we're very supportive of the state putting up funding for the Parent Aware rating system. The governor's budget request only funds about half the level that we believe is needed to grow the program in the way that we expect it to grow in the coming years. And we encourage this committee to consider funding Parent Aware because of its central importance to the early education system in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Please proceed.
Hello, thank you so much. It's a pleasure of being by being here. My name is Maria Veronica Suetas, and I'm a physician. I'm a primary care physician. I'm here represented Hennepin, HCMC, and my beloved program at Iperati. I'm a fellow of the Society of Adolescent Health and Medicine, and I'm also a fellow of the American Academy of Family Physicians. So let me just say that it's an honor and a pleasure to be here to testify in behalf of the governor's budget proposal in support of the creation of behavioral health homes. If the health home initiative becomes law, Minnesota will join Wisconsin, Idaho, Ohio, South Dakota, Alabama, and other states that have, with bipartisan support, taken advantage of this opportunity. Behavioral health home will advance innovation in health, but most importantly, the model will allow Minnesota to do something about an area we were lagging. It will help the state decrease our state health inequity gap, as the model has the potential to do that with a whole set of measures where Minnesota has weakest score compared to most other states. Innovation in healthcare is daunting and intricate. As usually, no matter what the excellence or advantages that the new model brings to communities and patients, the changes in the payment system to accommodate those innovations travel slower than that. And think of the thunder, the innovation happens in the field faster, illuminating the care of our patient, and you hear the noise that you made in billing after, as innovation in payments comes later. Healthcare is undergoing a huge transformation, moving away from sickness to embrace wellness and working on strengthening, protecting, preventing, using tools borrowed by its close relative, public health. It is also becoming integrative instead of only specialized, moving away from compartmentalization to integration of wellness. This new concept that is centered in an individual as a whole brings the potential to unleash the power of everyone, not only to conquer health, but to conquer the best life that you can possibly dream, propelling your strengths and making sure our clients become an active, self-sustained, positive force in our communities by virtue of receiving integrated care that connected all the dots around a person: health, family, work, education. All these components matter in this model with the same strengths. In our program at Iperati, we established in 2002 a model that today, 2014-15, collects national and international awards for innovation. 12 years later, we were able to show what trust in primary care can do, using a model that is rooted in that, in integration and family-centered care, powered by an interdisciplinary team devoted to deliver evidence-based intervention, using the power of positive youth development, a framework that brings that spin to care. That healthcare is moving toward a value-based system paying for quality and efficiency, it's not a question, it's a reality. But to follow that transformation, we need to create venues to move away from our tangled payment system focused on disease and move new billing models faster to protect our current care models, as they're not sustainable under the current payment system. This is what behavioral health home will do: bring innovation in the care with the proper payment changes attached to it from the beginning, and use that reimbursement to leverage evidence-based services. Iperati is an established healthcare home that will become one of the few implementers of the primary care behavioral home models, if you choose so, making the model self-sustain. And I'm here just to say again that it's an honor to back the recommendation to establish the behavioral home in Minnesota, as it will be an honor to be here testifying about achievements in the future once we establish as the first behavioral home is implemented. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Dr. Slitez. Next up, we have Rich German, followed by Rebecca Covington on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rich German. I'm the Executive Director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota and also a member of the Governor's Task Force on Child Protection. And as the Executive Director of Safe Passage, we are an advocacy organization in the child welfare arena. And I first want to say a few words in support of the Governor's recommendations in the budget that are coming out of the preliminary recommendations of the task force. This includes 11 positions at the Department of Human Services, which are primarily to provide more structure, oversight, and training for the screening process, as well as for child fatality reviews. We've said for several years that there is a need for more infrastructure at the State Department of Resources to provide the support and quality assurance needed in the counties. And also, in this regard, as the task force has moved forward, what we've seen is that the department has provided really good leadership. It's allowed us to move quickly and address a number of these issues. I think those of you who have received visits over the years from me and from some of our volunteers know we wouldn't be saying that if we didn't really think it was true, and we really do appreciate the department's leadership. We do think that these positions are needed to provide appropriate checks and balances and make sure that the quality of the program increases. Also, I'm on the work group for the task force that is dealing with resources, and I think I don't see the department positions in contrast or instead of positions for the counties. We're just simply at the part of the process and going through this where we are working on those issues. I don't have a crystal ball, but I'm hopeful that the final recommendations of the task force, which are due the end of March, will include some recommendations regarding additional support for the counties and also probably some new initiatives to deal directly with racial disparities and with rebuilding the service network out in the counties. So I thank you for your time and just ask for your support for these budget proposals. Thank you.
Thank you for your time and for your testimony. Ms. Covington, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Rebecca Covington, and I serve as the Executive Director for the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. And we are a broad-based coalition of advocacy and provider organizations that work to change public policy to improve the quality of life for individuals with disabilities. Thank you for this opportunity to address the governor's budget. I would like to speak to two items that were not included in the governor's budget that the consortium believes needs strong consideration for inclusion in both the governor's supplemental budget as well as within the budget target that this committee will have to work with this session. Many on this committee are familiar with both medical assistance, or MA, income standards and asset limits for individuals with disabilities and seniors, as well as MAEPD, or medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. These programs allow for individuals with disabilities to access support and services necessary to maintain the goals of independence and integration in communities of their own choosing and to pursue meaningful employment. As the state moves towards fulfilling the philosophy of the Olmstead Plan, individuals with disabilities who need the waiver support services accessible through MA are still required to spend down to 75% of the federal poverty guideline, or $730 a month if they make a dollar over 100% of the federal poverty guideline, and retain only $3,000 in assets. With such income and asset limits in place, it will be impossible to achieve the vision of Olmstead for our state. The increase in MAEPD monthly premiums, which took effect on October 1st of 2014, caused significant hardships for many of the 8,500 individuals with disabilities that participate in this work incentive program, negatively impacting their ability to maintain independence and achieve stability in communities of their own choosing. With increased premium payments, many individuals are left wondering how they are going to meet the financial obligations of paying their mortgages and maintaining their homes and paying their other bills. We look forward to having legislation addressing both of these policies heard in this committee later this session, so I'll save additional details for that time and have Carrie Sheldon illustrate the impact that MAEPD premiums have had on the quality of her life.
Good afternoon, Chair and Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Sheldon. I have been on medical assistance since 1986. Since then, I have been on MAEPD only a couple of times since the early 2000s when the program started. I was financially capable of paying all my bills while I worked because my premium was only $40. If I didn't work, I would have to pay a spend down of $426 off of my SSDI. Having a job helps me keep from having to pay the spend down. In September of 2014, I received a letter telling me about a change to the MAEPD program that was passed by legislature a few years ago. This change was an increase in MAEPD premiums. This change took effect in October 2014. Instead of paying $40, I now have to pay $123 for medical expenses. When I had to start paying the higher amount in October, I started having difficulty paying my bills. I was not even able to save money to go home for Thanksgiving. Ever since the increase, I am also not able to pay all of my bills in full. My Xcel energy bill is so high that I had to apply for energy assistance, but I still fear that I will be kicked out of my apartment. If these changes continue, no one who pays a medical spend down or medical premium will be able to pay the bills that matter or even their copays. Many people I have talked to have told me they refuse to work because it messes with their benefits. I see their point. Paying the higher amount would be the same as paying the spend down, since the amounts are basically the same. I also feel that paying the higher premium amounts will prevent people with disabilities to get ahead. This is very unfair for people with disabilities who are nearing retirement. We should be able to save money for medical issues that come up as we age. I ask that you support increasing asset limits to SSI, SSDI, and RSDI for people with disabilities and decreasing the premium amounts. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Mr. Bill Adams, and on deck, Dominic Sposetto. Please proceed with your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bill Adams, and I am pleased to be here today in support of the State Health Improvement Project, SHIP. I have submitted written testimony to the committee and will highlight just a few points of it to conserve time. I live in West Central Minnesota near Fergus Falls, and I have worked in public policy, including healthcare public policy, for more than 30 years now, and after a heart attack, public policy became personal. I got involved with the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement on their Patient Advisory Council, and that has led to many other opportunities, including SHIP, where I serve on the Citizen Leadership Team for the Partnership for Health, which is the SHIP project in our area. Partnership for Health covers Clay, Becker, Otter Tail, and Wilkin counties. As a CLT member, I get to learn much of the work that SHIP is doing, and I've been incredibly impressed with what has been accomplished. I'll highlight one project that SHIP was involved with, a collaborative in our community of Fergus Falls. Last spring, SHIP, along with the local hospital, with Otter Tail County Public Health Department, the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, helped launch a series of community conversations about health, healthcare, and healthcare costs. We had over 100 people who participated in those conversations. that ultimately led to a successful application to become one of the 12 new Minnesota Accountable Communities for Health, another project growing out of those community conversations. We are undertaking a community-wide project to have conversations about how we as individuals want to be cared for if we are diagnosed with chronic health conditions or life-threatening illness. This has been shown in other areas where it has been done to both improve the quality of health care and to lower the costs. I'll also highlight the food hub that opened in Fergus Falls this past year. The food hub connects the institutional buyers, in this case the schools, with the local growers. Previous to the food hub, the institutions had no good way to contact the growers. The Partnership for Health, along with the Lake Country Services Cooperative, created the food hub, and it has been very successful in its first year. It's also a great economic development tool for the growers as they have a ready market for their produce. There are a number of other things that I've highlighted in the written testimony that I have provided to the committee. I want to thank then Governor Tim Pawlenty for his wisdom in creating the original SHIP project, for Governor Dayton for including $35 million in his budget this year, and urged the legislature to continue that level of funding. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Adams, for your testimony and for all your good work volunteering. Mr. Sposetto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dominic Scuzzetto. I'm a contract lobbyist representing the Minnesota Dental Association, and I will be very brief. I think Dr. Helgeson did a very, very good job of portraying the situation with dental care reimbursement in the state. As he said, we are the worst in the country. That's not much to be proud of. But we are pleased that the governor did see fit to include in his budget a small increase in dental reimbursement. In fact, it's the first time in my memory that we've seen the governor request a fee increase for dentists in his budget in a couple of decades. So I think that's probably good news. Unfortunately, it doesn't go far enough. I'm here to share with the committee that the Dental Association has put together a broad group of stakeholders from community clinics, FQHCs, Appletree, Hennepin County, some of the major health plans, Park Dental, and obviously the rural practitioners that the Dental Association represents, and we'll be bringing forth the proposal to address the fee situation. We would like to take the fees up to the 50% of what dentists were paid in 2012. Now that'll be a heavy lift. It's probably about 85% higher than what they're getting paid now, but let me just leave you with this thought. As Garrison Keeler like to say, that we from Minnesota are all good looking and above average. Unfortunately, as it comes to dental reimbursement, we are not above average. And so we will be bringing forth a proposal to perhaps take us from worst to truly mediocre. And hopefully put us in the companionship of some of those wonderful states known for their healthcare innovation as Alabama and Georgia and West Virginia and Mississippi. So we'll look forward to addressing that issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
At least you didn't say Wisconsin. All right. Thank you, Mr. Sposetto. Next up, we have Dan Quinlan from Isaiah. And then on deck, we have Terry Thurlow and Aaron Bowie. Please proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dan Quinlan. I co-chair the Isaiah Health Equity Committee. Isaiah is a faith-based organization made up of 100 churches located in the metropolitan area and parts of greater Minnesota. Sharing our abundance and reducing economic and racial disparities have long been central tenets for churches in our organization. We have been advocates in expanding access to quality health care through protection and enhancement of the state medical assistance, Minnesota Care, and the ACA. These programs have played a dramatic role in reducing the state's uninsured rate by over 37% from 2013 to 2014. In the case of Minnesota Care, Let me speak from personal experience. I have two adopted Korean sons in their early 30s. In their late 20s, both were struggling to get started, and both were eligible and received Minnesota care. Today, one is an assistant manager for a clothing store in Edina. The other is a special education teacher in Bemidji. Neither receive subsidized health care today. But over the next 35 years, they will repay the state many times in taxes and in educating children with special needs. Minnesota care works. While Isaiah supports the governor's budget, we are concerned that it contains $60 million in cuts to Minnesota care, shifting costs to Minnesotans at the 150 to 200% of the federal poverty level through higher premiums, deductibles, and co-pays. We need to recognize that these working families are on the economic edge, with single-member households earning only $8.42 to $11.22 per hour. The uninsured are disproportionately people of color. We cannot pay lip service to reducing racial disparities and then make it more difficult for communities of color to get health insurance. By increasing premiums on people in Minnesota care, we seriously risk both slowing our progress towards having the lowest uninsured rate in the country and reducing health care disparities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next we have Carrie Thurlow and Aaron Bowie. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Aaron Bowie. I am the Director of Government Affairs for the Care Providers of Minnesota, and along with my colleague here today, on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. You have heard about the daunting demographic challenge we are facing. There will be 60,000 new seniors each year, and they are all living longer. In just 5 short years, there will be more seniors than children. So what do these demographic numbers mean? From our perspective, the key issues brought by the explosive growth in seniors are more demand for services. As Minnesotans live longer, it is more likely they will need some form of senior care. All seniors deserve quality care, and the state will need to devote more resources to that care. We need a lot more quality caregivers. We already face a shortage in caregivers, and we will need to partner with you to address that shortage with multiple strategies. We will need to support and fund the full continuum of senior care services. Doing so will ensure that seniors have options for care and that state resources are used wisely. That means supporting nursing homes, as they will always play a vital role in meeting the needs of the seniors, but not to the exclusion of home and community-based services such as assisted living, home care, adult day services, and other community supports. We need to reform our system of paying for senior care so that it reflects our shared values. Paying caregivers an honorable wage, supporting innovation and quality, ensuring that seniors have access to the care they need in their communities. As you consider the governor's proposal, we ask that you continue to keep the following principles in mind. Help seniors remain in a place they call home for as long as you can. We'll preserve their quality of life and keep them surrounded by people who love them. Fully fund what we all believe is needed for quality care. We need to make sure the investment is equal to the care expected by seniors, their families, and all Minnesotans. Invest in caregiving as a long-term profession. We know that quality care is best provided with a consistent, stable workforce. This is why workforce development and caregiver investment are so critical to us. Help families get prepared for the future, financially and emotionally. We need to continue to develop mechanisms to empower seniors and their families to plan and save for their senior care needs. Now, as we turn to the specifics of the governor's budget, if we were looking at the glass as having something in it, we could highlight a few areas. Our organization's members and staff participate in the state's e-health committees and work groups and support these efforts. Health Information Exchange, or HIE, has evolved considerably since when the oversight law was first enacted. The changes the health department is proposing will not only help account for new forms of HIE under the oversight law, but also make the certification process less burdensome for those companies entering Minnesota's market. The two own your future components, the creation of the clearinghouse and further work on a life stage planning insurance product. Both of these items are important steps towards encouraging and enabling more people to plan for their health care as they age. The governor's recommendations regarding the creation of a new home and community-based services innovation pool. This pool will serve to incent innovation in the provision of home and community-based services. Under the supplemental nursing services, we support this to help assure quality caregivers. And finally, the governor's recommendation to change group residential housing to ensure quality services and setting for people with low income and disabilities. And I will turn it over to Carrie now to talk about the priorities that were not included in the governor's budget.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So Aaron got to be the good cop today. I get to be the bad cop and talk about the not-so-good news in the governor's budget. And I will promise to be brief because I think I'm the last testifier today on the schedule. So Governor Dayton did not include any increases for our senior care system in terms of increased funding for our senior care providers throughout the state. And when I talk about our senior care system, I'm including nursing homes, but also our home and community-based services that Aaron talked about. While we are happy that the governor has asked to preserve some previously scheduled rate increases, a 3.2% in average increase for care centers set to take effect on October 1st of this year, and a 1% quality add-on for home and community-based services that is set to take effect on July 1st, we think that our growing aging population really requires us to do more than that and to really think about how we're funding our system and to come up with a new reform system that will take us into the future. And so we've really done some different thinking about this and have come forward with a reform proposal that will not only put the investments needed into our system to help us pay our caregivers the honorable wage that is needed, to create the pipeline for the workforce that we're needed, and to begin to address the shortage of caregivers that we have, but also take us into the future so that Minnesota seniors have access to the care they need in their hometowns when they need it. We've had lots of conversations in the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee about the changing demographics, the shortages and the vacancies that we have, over 1,800 positions open just in nursing homes alone, and the impact that that's had on seniors. And we look forward to having that conversation here as well as having a conversation about a bill that we're bringing forward that enjoys bipartisan support that would restructure that payment system and take us forward. So thank you for the opportunity today, and we look forward to the opportunity to continuing this conversation with all parties involved going forward.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow, Ms. Bowie. We appreciate your testimony. Also appreciate all of the testifiers today, and apologize for having to keep it so brief to accommodate everybody. Also thank the members for your attentiveness. And with that, we are adjourned for the day.